It is with such gratitude that we welcome back our listeners for this third segment in our four-part series on conversations on living and dying well. My name is Lissa DeFreitas, and I will be your host today as we explore spirituality in living and dying well. We have the gift of a panel of palliative care experts, as well a wisdom-inspired spiritual care team that have joined us this morning at the Care4Y studio. We will have the gift of bringing together some of the key elements or tools for the journey of living and dying well. Looking back in that first segment, we looked at the full continuum of living life, which absolutely includes dying and death. It was gently named the elephant in the living room, and yet for many, facing a life-limiting illness, loss, or a disabling condition assisted others in more fully and consciously embracing life. Please join me this morning in welcoming our panel members, Dr. Nicole Pelly from Kootenai Health, Father Nolan Redman, Episcopal priest serving both Bonner and Boundary County, and Paul Graves, our local founder of the Geezer Forum, the Elder Mays, and longtime hospice volunteer chaplain and Methodist minister. Welcome all this morning. I would love to address this first question to everyone on the panel. What are some stories or lessons that you learned from companioning with others at the end of life? What were your takeaways?
In palliative care, I say that the story of a person is at the very center of our dialogue in palliative care. And so in my job as a palliative care physician, I listen and hope to elicit a person's story, because if we can understand who the person is, that then helps us as a medical system guide and choose therapies that are appropriate for the stage of illness that they're in. So I say that the story of a person, who they truly are, how they met their husband, how many children they have, what do they like to do, what were their hobbies when they still had the energy to do them, things like that, are really, really important as framework to start from.
So it sounds like what you're saying, part of what your takeaway is your stepping in and being present in conversation with them. Through your questions, you're inviting them to have a dialogue with themselves and to explore deeper what has meaning for them.
My job is to amplify who they are as a person, because that usually gives us the answers that they're seeking for as they approach the end of their life.
In over 50 years of working with people who are in the dying process, and within survivors of the persons who have died, both as a pastor and as a social worker, I've seen such a mix of responses to the perceived reality of dying. Some of the fear, a good deal, and increasingly a good deal of acceptance of what is happening, but I think a lot of what happens is in my experience anyhow, an observation, is that we have to get past our own language, our own vocabulary. Quick example: I'm currently working with a couple. He has cancer. I don't know if it's technically been identified as terminal, but they think it is, and I was out to see them in their home before Christmas, and the wife and the husband had different understandings of why I was there, with his permission, but she was wanting to be talking about funeral arrangements and religious things. He and I talked about things that were meaningful to him. He never talked about religion. He happened to be raised as a youngster in the Methodist tradition, which tied us together some, but we never really talked about that. But he was talking about his marriage, he was talking about his work, about the life that he and his wife had shared for 51 years. He was telling stories. Afterwards, I got a call an email from her, somewhat apologizing because we didn't get to her agenda. her understanding of what spirituality connotes, which is identifiable religious kinds of things. And I wrote back to her, and then we subsequently had a phone call visit. And I was saying, but your husband was talking spirituality. He was just using a different language than you do. Because he was talking about life purpose, life meaning. And to me, that's what spirituality encompasses.
I love what you're sharing, Paul, because there is so much in what you're sharing, actually. The first thing that comes to my mind is you're meeting up with this family, but recognizing that each of them they're in their own unique place in the journey. And yet you are also able to assist this one in recognizing how their partner was framing that spirituality. And it's almost like that you build a bridge of connection, not just with you and them, but them with each other.
Actually, I think that did start the conversation because the wife expressed real appreciation for what I said, because she was willing to expand her understanding of the word spirituality.
The role of storytellers in our world has changed. We're no longer gathered around a fire listening to stories and dark winter nights. And when I talk with my patients about the stories of their lives, their children will interrupt and say, "You never told me that. I've never heard that before." And it's a key piece of this person's life that they've never shared with their family for whatever reason. And I find that to be one of the best gifts I can give the family, is participating in those conversations that patients and I have because of what they get to hear. Sometimes we don't think of our parents, and we think of our parents as our parents. We don't think of them as people with stories of their own. And so when families actually get to hear the stories that are important to their mother or their father, it also brings another gift into the picture at the close of a person's life.
Storytelling is so powerful, and I love what you shared, that we're not a society that often does that anymore. And yet there's certain environments, I want to say, where that's invited to happen. It kind of brings to mind a situation that happened for me several decades ago, but I was at bedside with my harp playing for a family, and I said, I'm not performing. I'm here to be in presence with each of you. And so if you have stories to share, please share them. And it was just this wonderful blending of music and storytelling. And the family came together and they were sharing on a level that was just opening my heart so much. But the gift was that they could come together and to be in that story, experiencing it in a whole new way.
I think the gift of that intentional storytelling also gives a gift to the others in the room of listening. And so often we don't think of listening in a powerful presence way as being a gift, but it really is. It's a gift to be able to listen to a person's stories.
Dr. Pelley, when you said the gift of listening, and I'm thinking about my own experience, between Paul and me, we have about 100 years of doing this sort of thing. And reflecting on my experience, has been less about telling people about death and dying and acting like some sort of an expert, and more of listening and trying to discover where they are in their journey and not prejudge where they might be or what their experience might be, but to listen for them and to see what's going on in their lives, no matter what kind of a situation it is. And so I've learned to do a lot of growing, as I have had years of being by the bedside of people who've died and were dying. When I was in a parish in California, I was beginning to say that San Jose is a carcinogen because so many members of my congregation were suffering from cancer. And so I had a variety of experience sitting with these people and growing with them. But I want to share with you an experience that I had that was probably a real turning point in my life. I had a parish in Central Washington that had a wonderful nursing home in the community. And a member of that parish was a night nurse at the nursing home. And she and I had conversations about her experience. And one day she said, "Would you be willing to come and sit with people when they are facing death? Because I don't have time as my nursing job." And she said, "Could I just call you up and invite you to come down and be with them?" And we did that for about 3 years before she moved away. And I have to tell you that those years of coming down with no particular point of view from my point to come and tell them something, but just to join them and sit and hold their hand, I would always approach them and say, "Would you like me to pray with you?" And sometimes they'd say yes, and sometimes they would say no. And I would say, "Would you like to have me stay here for a while?" Sometimes it would be quite some time. But over those years, I experienced that I was in a very special spiritual place as these people were dying. And I began to recognize that we need to pay attention to what people are going through, not only in the midst of their vibrant life, but also as that life comes closing down. And to be filled with an expectancy of something new is happening. Something is coming to life, even in the midst of death.
I love the word expectancy. In that, we don't truly know what it is that will be brought forward. But to trust the moment, to trust and allow, that's what I was hearing you say, Nolan, is that you were allowing it to be whatever it needed to be. As a person, as a learner, as a listener, as bearing witness to.
We tend to focus as a society on the loss associated with death, both for the people who are left behind and the person who no longer is living the life that they have been living. I often wonder how powerful would it be if we could reframe our cultural expectations with expectancy? What if we reframed our thoughts that this person was going on a wonderful journey and that we included joy along with our loss? It's a hard thing to do. It's not easy to do. We think about how excited we are for friends who go off on magnificent journeys around the world. What if we took that framework and applied that for at least part of the time in the dying process? Maybe this person really is going on an exciting journey, one that we can't join them on at this point in time. But how would we feel different? And how empowering could that be for the person who is dying? Because so much of the fear on the journey is the fear of the unknown. I believe that our bodies know how to die. I see it in my patients as they get closer to death. There's a change in them. And oftentimes when you ask a person who's within a month or two of their death, "Are you dying?" they will raise their head, look you directly in the eye, and say, "Yes, I know I'm dying." Their family members don't, because they don't feel what that feels like in a dying body, don't have the same sense or understanding, and so they struggle more with hearing those words. But the person who is dying knows it very clearly and very well. And I find that interesting that our bodies know how to die. I think that our soul and our spirits know how to die. But we as a world need to change the way we think about this end of lifetime and make it more of a proactive expectancy. Embrace what can be.
Embracing the unknown, And then thinking about what Jenna shared with us that first day when she was talking about that place of luminosity, where that person was partly here, partly somewhere in the great mystery of wherever that is for them, and how sometimes that can be difficult for families because they're not able, like you're saying, to experience what that is actually like. But the ability to be present to it and to bring a place of allowing is a beautiful gift.
There's a word, liminal, L-I-M-I-N-A-L, and it describes that in-between stage when we've left where we were, but we aren't quite where we're going. And I find this stage at the end of our lives often is a very liminal stage. And if we can be open to the gifts that it brings and embrace those gifts along with acknowledging the sorrows, then I think that we can change the way we view this part of our lives.
I think what you're saying, Nicole, is exciting, because the expectations that that people have about their here and now life can be really shaping their understanding of whatever happens after the physical death. I'm thinking of a lady that was one of the residents in a nursing home where I was director of social services, and her doctor, who also happened to be my doctor, so we had a relationship. He ordered a spiritual consult, and because he could see in his visits with her that she was having some serious issues about her own dying process. Well, it turns out I had known the lady for some years in another context. I knew her to be a very religious person, in the sense that she embraced her understanding of God and the church and the Bible in very traditional ways. So I went to see her and found out she was scared, really scared. And the more we talked, it became clear to me that her understanding of God was that of a judgmental God, and she was simply afraid that she hadn't measured up. She had done everything that her church and that her own heart had been trained to expect. That's that expectation that you're talking about is what made me think about her. We talked a couple times before she actually died. I had no idea whether what we talked about made any difference for her, but I figured after she died that she was in for a big surprise. I still think that. I have been willing for a number of years to identify myself as agnostic when it comes to understanding what happens after death, because I don't know. By the way, the liminal word that you used, that means threshold. And so it's a marvelous word. And that's the thin places that I was referring to in a off-air conversation that we had.
And when we get to those thin places, those liminal places, I view it as an opportunity where we can strip away what doesn't matter, where we can have depth in our conversations with our family members or our friends, but where we can also have lightness of being. Many of the most joyful moments in our life actually aren't in deep conversation. They're gathered before dinner, around a table, with friends that we love being with, talking about the football game. Those can be very, very, very powerful moments. And so we need to remember at the end of our life to really, enjoy those moments of our daily days as we go through them, and to embrace them also at the end of our life, that we don't have to make this all just a serious thing, that there can be a lot of laughter throughout this process.
That's all about the living life.
And that's part of this conversation that we wanted to begin, is that so often when we talk about the elephant in the room and the dying process, who really wants to talk about that? But actually, the point of dying well is that we've lived well. And I've often thought, whether I die tomorrow in an unforeseen auto accident or I die 50 years from now, the best compliment that my family and friends who are left behind could say about me is, wow, she really knew how to live life, didn't she? She really did that well. That's what I want each of us to feel every day, to go into our days and say, how am I going to do this day today really, really well?
One thing that I'd like to add is the word threshold that you used. I found that the frequent experience I had where people were afraid to let go. And sometimes it seemed to be that my role was to, in some way, give them permission to let go. They would move from being anxious and fretting about letting go. And then when they would just relax into it, things would change for them. I noticed people being filled with stress sometimes at they're going through this. And just being present with them and reassuring and sounding hopeful and caring without preaching at them, but accepting where they're going and saying, it's okay. This is okay. This is not a bad thing for you.
That brings up something that I want to just throw out to each of you. One of the things that I notice with hospice is pain. Pain is a part, can be a part of the dying process. And even though we might assist in administering medicine to help bring comfort, we notice that there sometimes can be spiritual pain, or I'll just call emotional pain or spiritual pain. And maybe that kind of ties in with the story you were sharing, Paul, in that she was saying something to you as, I'm afraid.
Absolutely.
And sometimes people come to the end of their life with, I want to say, unfinished business or maybe relationships that didn't exactly go well for them, or things they wish they would have said or done. And that kind of goes back to what you were saying about living life well. But when we get to the end of our life and that hasn't occurred and there's things happening, it sometimes can present as spiritual pain. Can any of you address that or have seen that?
I see that daily. In my role as a palliative care physician, I obviously think about pain control and ask the pain questions, but I'm struck by how rarely I make alterations to pain medications and how frequently the pain that they're feeling is about something else. A child they haven't spoken to for many years, something they want to tell their spouse, something that's not done yet, a goal that they have. That's the majority of the pain that I actually deal with in palliative care, not the physical kind.
I'm thinking of another lady that I worked with some years ago, and she was in the last stages of her life, and she knew it, and she was willing to talk about that. And one day in our visit, I asked her, what would you like to see happen before you die? And she said, I want my family to be at peace, which was a very predictable thing for her to say, knowing her as I did. Unfortunately, she died before that could happen. And part of the reason was that the family wasn't, her children and their spouses were stuck in a place where they were not able to deal with what they all saw as root issues of conflict. And so she died unfulfilled of that promise. And I see that far too often. I think probably you do too, Nicole.
I want to go back to something Father Nolan said about giving permission, because often when we have people close, very close to the end of their life, we encourage family members to give them permission to go. All of us in medicine have worked in the ICU and seen that patient who hung on through the night until 5:02 in the morning when the family left to get that morning cup of coffee after being at the bedside all night long. Just as the family leaves to get that cup of coffee, the patient suddenly, quote unquote, dies. And it's almost as if some people have an easier time dying when their families aren't around. And yet the family members feel such guilt for clustering around the bedside and holding on to them. And they're upset that the family member has chosen to die when they're gone. And I want to really reframe that and encourage people to think about, people die on their own time and their own place. Sometimes they need the time with family gathered around the bed, and then they need time alone to begin whatever that journey is. There's no right or wrong way to do this, but the more that family members can and friends can encourage people who are at that very last stage of life, tell them that it's okay to go, we're going to be okay, we want you to be at peace now, we don't want you to suffer anymore, give them that permission, I think that does make it easier for that dying person to actually die.
I want to share an observation that I've had over my life, is that oftentimes you point out that they wait for the family member to leave. The other side of that is that many, many times in my experience that I've come to be there with them, and it's like they waited for me to get there, or a special family member. There was kind of a waiting that was going on. So we really can't determine how what they need at that end point. Sometimes it's to be left alone. Sometimes it's to have that reassuring presence. It just, everybody has their own experience, and I know that I try to just be available in any way that they need me. Giving permission is part of it.
That makes me, when you talked about letting go and giving permission earlier, Nolan, I got thinking of another of a hospice client that I worked with probably 20 years ago. She had end-stage cancer, and she and her family, who were very attentive in a very positive way, were trying to help. They were trying to help her understand that they were going to be okay. And so they would say, as they were taught by the hospice staff, to let her know that we're okay. If you know, when it's time for you to let go, please do so. She wouldn't die. And this went on for a couple weeks. And they were getting frustrated. And as I visited with her a little bit, I began to think, I wonder if she's feeling guilty because she hasn't died yet. You know, I was just really trying to think out of the box. So one day during the hospice care meeting, I was telling this story, and I said, what if we ask the family to stop saying that? Because the more they hear that, or the more she hears that from them, maybe she's feeling guilty. And so the staff at the care meeting said, well, give it a try. So I went to the family and explained our weird kind of new approach. They stopped saying, it's time, you know, it's okay for you to go, Mom. And within a couple of days, she died. It was stunning to all of us that something so, she obviously was the exception that proved the rule.
What's so powerful in that is that when someone is maybe non-responsive or unconscious, they're still able to be present to the conversations and the energy and the feelings and that sense of, uh-oh, what have we done wrong? How come you're not going? You know, and feeling that and then going through their own inner process. Sometimes we are not aware that journey is happening in another level, not necessarily on the physical level, but on another level of whatever that is. Might it be, could we call it life review? Could we call it whatever it is that they're completing within themselves before they leave this world? What are some thoughts that you have had or experienced around life review, people in it at that time of death or close to that time?
There's so much that we don't know about this from a scientific perspective even. And so I try to approach it from a very open-minded place of we just don't know, and realize that each person has different experiences and each family has different experiences. One of the questions I often ask my patients is, what do you think happens after you die? And the reason that I ask it is because it opens up a conversation with the person and their family members. It allows the person to talk about whether they're afraid. And actually, most of the time, my patients say, you know, I'm actually not really afraid to die. I'm afraid of what comes before. Sometimes they have very different opinions about what they think happens after they die. Some of my patients think nothing happens after you die. They just die. But it allows us to have a conversation, often a spirited conversation, and may plant some seeds and some stories that the family members can carry with them after the person actually does die. I think that we have to remember that while we use the words like spirituality and we often have people who come from religious backgrounds. We have just as many patients who may not have spiritual beliefs, who may not have a religious background of any kind, and who in fact may be atheists and don't believe anything comes after we die. And it's very, very important to, once again, allow people to be where they are and to not over-focus at the end of life on spirituality, but to focus on humanness. I think that we know how to be born, and I think we know how to die, and that is a part of the human journey that we're all on.
Paul, you had mentioned that there was a special reading you would like to share with us. I'm just wondering if this might be a good time now to share it.
It comes from a book called On the Brink of Everything, Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old. Written by a wonderful author, Parker Palmer. And his last chapter is called Over the Edge, Where We Go When We Die. But he talks first about Saint Benedict, the originator of the order of Benedictine spirituality from the mid-5th, 6th century. Let me share this. One of Benedict's precepts instructs the monks who were living a very ordered, highly structured life to, and I'm quoting here, to keep death daily before one's eyes. And then Parker goes on to say, the first time I read this line, it struck me as a bummer. Why should I look away from my vital and engaged life to contemplate my mortality? Now that some years have passed, I know at least two good answers to that question. The first answer, he says, is that there's no need to wait until you die to collect your rewards in some heaven on high. Pay attention to what's right here, right now, and you'll be rewarded immediately. The beloved community is in our midst. Rightly understood, keeping death daily before one's eyes does not mean looking away from one's life. It means looking more deeply into it. The second reason I need to keep death daily before my eyes is also rooted in my experience. Nothing makes me more grateful for life, even in the hard times, than remembering that it's a pure gift that I didn't earn and won't have forever. Nothing motivates me more strongly to pay it forward than knowing that the time to share a gift is when I have it in hand.
I'd like to add a personal note here. As a stage 4 cancer patient, that when I was diagnosed with the cancer and then with the metastasis, I was given permission inside of myself to accept the reality of a death that may be near or far. But truth is, I live with death every day, not in a morbid way, but in a joyous way. I can say ultimately, I cherish and celebrate the days that I am given, and I don't fret about it. When death comes, death comes. But I will have lived my life as fully as I can. And that's one of the gifts of having a terminal diagnosis.
That's beautifully shared, Father Nolan. I want to thank each of you for your beautiful sharing and your insights as we explore living and dying well.
We are turning now to a call that's coming in directly to our KRFY studio.
It is with great gratitude that we celebrate the opportunity today to be in conversation with a very special guest, Frank Ostaseski. Frank is a beloved instrument of compassionate presence here in our Sandpoint community and has been a part of our Sandpoint Sangha for very many years, I would say decades. Frank is a pioneer and a national speaker in end-of-life care In 1987, he co-founded the Zen Hospice Project, the first Buddhist hospice in America. He guided that groundbreaking work for almost 20 years, establishing a long-standing model for mindfulness and compassionate care. And then in 2005, he founded the Metta Institute, training countless healthcare clinicians and caregivers and building a national network of educators, advocates, and guides for those facing life-threatening illness. He has distilled hard-won lessons from his own life journey and synthesized 30 years of being with dying into his personal brand of wisdom. And recently, he is the author of The Five Invitations, Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. We have Frank in our studio this morning, and he has offered his time to share with us at KFRY Studio in our Sandpoint community about his experience in companioning the dying. And I know, Frank, I want to welcome you today, and I thank you for being with us and for tying and linking with us here in Sandpoint. Good morning and welcome.
Well, good morning, and I'm so happy to be here. I have lots of friends in Sandpoint, and I have a great affection for the community at large, and I've been involved with the Bonner County Hospice for many, many years, and so I'm very happy to support this work.
Thank you so very much.
You know, I was thinking that we might just speak a little bit about some of the work that's covered in my book, The Five Invitations.
That would be beautiful.
And, you know, the book starts out with a very simple idea, which is that life and death are a package deal. You can't pull them apart. You don't get one without the other, you know. In fact, in Japanese Zen, there's a word. It's called shoji. And it roughly translates as birth-death. No separation between life and death other than a small hyphen, a thin line that connects the two. So I really believe that we can't be really truly alive without maintaining an awareness of death. And my view on this is that death is not just waiting for us at the end of a long road, at the end of a long-term illness, for example. I think it's always with us. I think it's in the marrow of every passing moment. I think she's the secret teacher, hiding in plain sight. She helps us to discover what matters most. And the really good news is that we don't have to wait until the end of our lives to realize the wisdom that she has to teach. So I thought that might be interesting for us to talk about.
Absolutely, because it's right here and right now, in this moment.
Yeah. I mean, I think to imagine that at the time of our dying, we're going to have the physical strength, the emotional stability, the mental clarity to do the work of a lifetime is a kind of ridiculous gamble.
Yes.
So I think we need to do it now. So my book, The Five Invitations, is actually an invitation to sit down with death, to have a cup of tea with her, to get to know her really well, you know, so that she can guide us toward living a more meaningful and I think, loving life. You know?
Mm. Yes.
That's what interests me.
Yes. One of the things that I was just remembering is something that you shared recently in an email, and you mentioned death is a good companion on the road to living well.
Yeah, I think so. I think without a reminder of death, it's easy for us to take life for granted, you know, and we become lost or in endless pursuits of self-gratification. I think, but when we keep death really close, you know, at our fingertips, it reminds us not to hold on too tightly. And I think maybe we take ourselves and our ideas a little less seriously. And I think we let go a little more easily. And maybe we come to recognize that death comes to everyone. And so understanding that, we get it that we're all in the same boat together. And in my mind, at least, this causes us to be a bit kinder and gentler with one another. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, I'm not romantic about dying. It's hard work. Maybe the hardest work we're ever going to do in this life. And it doesn't always turn out well. It can be sad and cruel and messy, but it can also be beautiful and mysterious. But most of all, it's normal. Mm. We all go through it. I mean, none of us are going to get out of here alive, right?
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. That is something in our culture that I think isn't always remembered, Frank. One of the things that I've heard before is in America, it's the only culture that I know that they think death is optional. You know, it's that sense that, oh, it happens to someone else or it's something I have to think about way down the road rather than I love that thought of just sitting down and having a cup of tea with death and recognizing that is a part of life.
Yes, absolutely. You know, if I would ask you, when is death going to come, most people would say later. And later gives us that comfortable distance, a kind of buffer, if you will, between ourselves and death. But constant change is not later. Constant change is now.
Yes.
Each and every moment, everything is always coming and going. You know, I was in Japan this spring for the blossoming of these beautiful flowers, you know, cherry blossoms. And the whole hillsides are covered with them. And, you know, they only last for a very short time. And the question that always emerges for me is, why are those cherry blossoms, these fragile things that only last for a week, why are they more precious to us, more beautiful to us than plastic flowers? I mean, plastic flowers last forever, right?
Yes.
But, you know, there's something about the fragility and the impermanence, if you will, of those flowers, those cherry blossoms, that invites us into their beauty, into their mystery, into a sense of wonder and gratitude. Mm. And I think that's true about our lives, too. I think the fact that death will come helps us to appreciate this life fully and completely, not by scaring us, but by recognizing that when we touch the precariousness of this life, we also come to appreciate its preciousness.
Oh, yes.
And then we want to live our life fully and completely. We want to tell the people we love that we love them. That's what's important about dying. It isn't about dying in some particular way. Yeah.
Truly beautiful.
You know, I worked with a lot of folks in San Francisco who lived on the streets. They were poor, often with triple diagnoses. That meant they had not only a life-threatening diagnosis, but oftentimes they had an addiction issue, and they often had issues with mental illness as well. It was very confusing to work with them. And if I was going to be useful to them, I had to be real, you know?
Yes.
That meant I had to look at my own relationship to dying. Yeah, it meant I had to understand something about my own grief, my own fear. Otherwise, if I didn't look at those things and I said to someone who was dying, I understand that you're afraid, they would know I was just guessing. And they would sniff out my sentimentality and my insincerity. And I wouldn't be a trustworthy refuge for them. So, you know, some of these folks, they came from cultures I didn't know. And they spoke languages I couldn't understand. And some of them had a deep faith that carried them through really difficult times, while others had sworn off religion years ago. You know, there was this wonderful Vietnamese man, I remember, Nguyen, and he was really scared of ghosts. And his roommate, Isaiah, was an African-American man who was very comforted by nightly visits from his dead mother. You know? So these two were strange roommates, right?
Yes.
There was a dad I worked with, a man who was a hemophiliac, contracted the HIV virus from a blood transfusion. But years, the year before, his son, who was a gay man, called him up to tell him that he was that he was a gay man and that he was HIV positive. And his father hung up on him. Mm-hmm. He hung up. And now when I met them both, they were both in twin beds in the same room being cared for by Agnes, you know, the son's mother and the father's wife. These were the folks who really taught me. You know, they are really my teachers. Everything I learned about caring for the dying, but also living life fully and with integrity, really came from being with people in their final days, weeks, moments of life. Yeah.
Beautifully shared.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I think that in every community, there ought to be a place. Just, you know, like we have beautiful museums and galleries where great paintings hang. And I think there ought to be a place where people can come to die respectfully, with integrity. And we can really turn to them and say, show us about living our lives. You know, show us what you've learned about living life. And you know, that would be really important for us to have such places, because not everybody can manage this at home, you know.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think that these folks that I've worked with over the years, they've invited me into their most vulnerable moments. And they made it possible for me to get up close and personal with death. And in the process, I think they taught me how to live.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a life that doesn't include death is just a half a life. Yeah?
Yes.
So let's have a conversation about it. It's wonderful that we're doing this radio program so that people will begin to have this conversation with friends and family members and neighbors. Yeah.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Frank.
Yeah. Well, I hope this has been of some small support to that conversation. You know, we didn't, but let me just say briefly here, the book is built around five ideas. We call them five invitations. And I'll just name them for you now, and then you can see whether or not they fit into your broadcast.
Absolutely.
The first of those is don't wait. You know, waiting is full of expectation. Waiting for the next moment to arrive, we miss this one. You know, how many times have I been with patients and their families, and the family has said, when is mom going to die? And waiting for that moment of death, we missed all the moments in between. So don't wait.
Yes.
That's the first one. Second one, welcome everything. Push away nothing. Now, that sounds good. It'd make a great bumper sticker, but how do we do that? To welcome something doesn't mean we have to like it or that we have to agree with it. It just means we have to be willing to meet it. It's at our doorstep. We're willing to invite it in so that we can see what it has to teach us. The great African-American writer James Baldwin said, there are many things in this life that we must face that we cannot change. Nothing can be changed until it's faced. Yeah?
Yes.
So welcome everything. The third one is bring your whole self to the experience. Bring your whole self to the experience. You know, we all like to look good. We want to, you know, give the impression of being intelligent or well put together, certainly more better than the mess that most of us are. So to bring your whole self forward doesn't mean just to bring forward your bright, shiny spots or all your skills or expertise. It means to bring forward your fear and your helplessness. Because when we're with someone who's dying, that's what allows us to build an empathetic bridge to their experience.
Yeah? Yes.
So bring your whole self to the experience. The fourth one is find a place of rest in the middle of things. And we always think we're going to find rest later, like when our list gets checked off or our email box is empty or when we go on vacation somewhere. I don't know about you, but my list is never checked off. So if I wait to rest until then, I'm in trouble. So I have to find a way of resting right in the middle of what I'm doing. And I think we do that by bringing our attention fully and completely to whatever it is that we're engaged in, and not scattering our attention over 17 different projects at the same time. So find a place of rest right in the middle of things, in the middle of activity. And a fifth and final one is cultivate don't know mind. I thought I should put something Zen-like in this list since I created the Zen Hospice Project. So this means not to cultivate a mind of ignorance. Not knowing is not ignorance. Ignorance is that we know something, but it's the wrong thing, and then we insist on it. There's a lot of that going on in the culture today. Not knowing is the willingness to be curious, to have a sense of wonder, to not have our brains so filled with our knowing that there's no room for anything else to enter. So it's this fresh eyes, seeing with fresh eyes, and a sense of discovery. So those are the five invitations, and I think they all intersect with one another. But it would be useful even to take one, you know, and practice it for a week and sort of see how it reframes the way in which we walk through our lives. You know, an invitation is a request for you to show up. Right? If I invite you to my house for dinner, you show up for that meal. These invitations are a request for you to show up for your whole life. Yeah, mm-hmm. And these are kind of guides to help you in doing just that.
Yes.
Thank you for inviting me. I hope it was something helpful.
Oh, it was absolutely helpful. These are foundational principles for living. What an exquisite opportunity for you to share that with us today, Frank. Thank you with all
Very
our hearts.
Very happy to share it.
Yeah.
And, you know, big love to all my friends there in Sandpoint. I'm going to come up in October, and we're going to do a non-residential retreat. That means that people can stay at home, come to the retreat, and practice together. We're going to be doing it for a few evenings and one weekend. And if they go to Sandpoint Sangha, that's S-A-N-G-H-A, to that website, they'll find the dates and information about how to participate in that retreat.
And will they also be able to sign up by going to the website?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. You
can sign up for the retreat right there. And also every Tuesday night at the Heartwood Center, there's a group of people who get together for meditation. And once a month, I Skype into that. And so people can come, want to learn, study with me some more, they can come to those Tuesday night groups. And they're every Tuesday night at, I think it's 6 o'clock. I could be wrong. But the website, Sandpoint Sangha, will direct them in the right way. Okay.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Frank. And we want to just extend our deepened appreciation to you and look forward to having you with us in October.
Okay.
Yeah.
I look forward to it.
Thank you so much.
Take good care.
You take good care as well.
All right.
All right. Blessings. I would like to take this opportunity as we close this piece on spirituality to end with a quote from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She says, "It is not the end of the physical body that should worry us. Rather, our concern must be to live while we're alive, to release our inner selves from the spiritual death that comes with living behind a facade designed to conform to external definitions of who and what we are. Throughout our conversations thus far, we have had the opportunity to truly traverse the continuum of living life all the way to the very end. And we have brought death into this continuum of living life, knowing and recognizing that each and every one of us truly have the opportunity to embrace both the living and the dying well. We explored the gift of living life with meaning and purpose, and to find a greater sense of hope and peace, and having a plan for how we will navigate a life-limiting illness, and how we will embrace death. Moreover, how we will embrace living. Throughout each and every segment of this podcast, the foundational principle that we have brought forward was that sense of being in conversation. In fact, it is an ancient word, and at the root of that means living together, coming together. And in conversation, we have that opportunity to be and to offer that gift of listening, to be present to ourselves and to others. As we do this, we provide a gift of support and of care. So may I offer again the gift of love and gratitude to each of you. Thank you. Thank you all for your gift of listening today in our third segment of our four-part series on living and dying well. May our hearts be open to explore this journey of living life. And it is our hope that this podcast conversation have perhaps planted seeds of great thought and inner reflection. May these seeds begin to blossom within us with deep roots of compassion, peace, and hope. We have the unique closing gift of having listened to the joined hearts and voices of our local Sandpoint Threshold Singers. This song is written and composed by Camille McKittrick. The Sandpoint Threshold Singers are part of a global not-for-profit organization that provides threshold presence of heart and song at the threshold time of life. For additional information, you can reach them at 208-274-3645.
No, that love is with you. deliver us.